today? Hey, okay. I'll get you the page number here. Page 1351 in my Bible. Okay. Remember that Daniel's experiences here are not in chronological order. They're jumped back and forth over the long time that he was in Babylon. And chapter 8 starts in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. A vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. Who was Belshazzar?
Grandson,
yes. And he was a nice guy, a nice moderate king. No, he wasn't a partier. And how long did he reign about? Three or four, 5 years maximum. And then, so we're catching him on the third year of his reign. And what happened? How did he die? He threw a great big banquet in the main palace. And that was the very night that the Medes and the Persians shut off the Euphrates River so that the army could come in under the gates and open the main gates to the city and let the Medes and Persian military army come in and take over in a bloodless coup, except Belshazzar got killed, right? So we're back during the time when Belshazzar's reigning. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the first one that appeared to me the first time. I saw in the vision, and it so happened that while I was looking, I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision that I was by the river Ulai. Shushan, you can find it on Google still if you want, was the summer capital. It's up about 250 miles east of Babylon, up in the Zagros Mountains, where the weather would be much nicer than hot Babylon. Babylon is a hot place in the summer. And from the language, you can't tell whether this is a daytime vision or a nighttime vision. It's not too clear. It seems that in the vision, Daniel is taken to Sushi, and that this happens there. So anyway, that's the place where this vision occurs to Daniel. It may have been in broad daylight, it might have been at night. And this city will be the main capital for the Persians in a few years. But Babylon's such a convenient place that for a while they're getting established, the Medes and Persians use Babylon as their main headquarters and the hub for internet and so on, I think. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had two horns, and two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. We have these animals in this last half of Daniel, and we see first a ram. That's a large male animal, and it has conventional two horns, but one horn's a little bigger than the other one. And I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward. That is moving in every direction except east. East would be off in the direction towards China and toward the heart of what's now Iran. No beast could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will, and he became great. We can find out who he is in a minute, or you can guess. You can start guessing if you want. As I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Now that's an unusual goat to have a... I don't think goats ever have one horn in between their eyes, do they? Unicorns do, but not goats. And it's notable. Anybody want to guess what these two animals, what they symbolize? The ram and the
I think that the ram, you know, the two horns represent Iraq and Iran, too.
Yes.
I don't know which one is greater.
They represent the Medes and the Persians. And the
what?
The Medes and Persians. You're right. It's Iraq and Iran. Yeah.
And the goat. It's the United States.
Oh, the U.S. Oh,
I'm not kidding. If you read on, you
oh, well, listen. Oh, I can't wait.
We'll talk about that.
I can't wait to find that. The goat with two horns, with a notable horn, is, who do you think that would be? If we're talking about nations in the Middle East in the ancient history, that's Greece. That would be Greece. And that would be Alexander the Great would be that one notable horn. But let's see how we can find that out a little bit later on. It's not entirely facetious to say put modern powers in there because history is repeating itself. We're coming right now in the time of history when these events are going to play back all over again. And... any day now, we're going to have a great new Iraq, which will be named Assyria. Persia is already in the news every single day. Are the Israelis going to bomb Persia this week or next week? And is Mr. Obama going to be in on that? And all of that it's very volatile right now because it's going to happen again. Let's look on. Verse 6, he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. So these animals are fiercely butting horns and quarreling, representing the Medes and the Persians contesting the rise of Alexander the Great. We've already been over that a time or two as something that happened in history. At the time of, after Daniel's time a little bit, I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore, the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Does anybody want to real quick tell us about how Persia was defeated by Alexander the Great? We went over it two or three times here already, and it is in the final exam. Yes. Yeah. Right.
In the battle, and I forget what's off the top of my head. Alexander's sitting above, and he's realizing that if he uses a pincer attack and a forward attack, he can break through the Persian Empire. And he uses his cavalry to surround it, and he breaks through, and with a smaller force, and he breaks the back of the empire.
Persian army is huge, great, massive army, and it controls that whole part of the world, which would be Turkey, and all the way down to India and over to Greece and down as far as Egypt. And it's formidable. And Alexander the Great comes in with an army of nowhere near that same size. But he's a tactician, and he's very clever in his campaign tactics. Alexander the Great had been a general for many years, and this was one of his great last exploits before retirement. Is that correct? No, that's not correct. How old is he when he's doing these battle campaigns? Yeah. In fact, he died about 32, and he was very forlorn because there were no more worlds left to conquer. And he'd conquered the whole known world, essentially, and life was boring after that. So if you're striving for success in your corporation and you get up to be the CEO, watch out, because that might be the point when you lose all interest in life. Okay. Verse 9. And out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evening mornings, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed." Now that's probably Greek to you. Well, it was translated from the Greek, but probably it doesn't make any more sense as if it was just Greece. So what this horn, this little horn of Daniel 8, is a symbol of somebody. These horns generally are people. But how does that fit? Is this a symbol for Daniel?
No.
No, absolutely not. Is this a good guy?
No.
Where is his origin? Alexander the Great, this is one of the horns that came after Alexander the Great, right? Or came from? Out of one of them came a little horn. We have these four generals whom we now know to be Cassander, Ptolemy, Lysimachus, and Seleucid. Remember, we have those. Okay. Somebody here says that we're picking the Seleucids to be the horn out of which this bad guy comes?
Yes.
Okay. Out of Alexander the Great's successors come these four generals, and they take over that whole region. And the region that's now Syria was left to the care of the Seleucids, a whole dynasty of Seleucids, and they were followed by four or five bad guys, of whom one of them we know from the New Testament, actually. And his name was Antiochus. Epiphanes? Okay.
He's the one that desecrated the temple.
Yeah, that's right. So, no, in the time period between the Old Testament and the New Testament, there are a whole bunch of historical things going on. This is the time for the rise of the Roman Empire. Rome comes to power, and Rome gets its toehold over in the Middle East, and there's all kinds of politics going on, and particularly back and forth between Syria and Egypt, a constant series of wars, with Israel accidentally caught in the way. Okay, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say that one of the reasons he attacked Israel is he actually went down against Egypt. And the Egyptians were sick and tired of him, and they were willing to compromise their sovereignty a little bit. So they asked Rome to send him a fleet of ships down to attack the guy. And so Antiochus backed off.
This is a wonderful story that we have historical records about this time period. And why is that important? Because somebody just like this bad guy is going to show up on the stage of history again.
Back through Israel, that's when he decided to attack Israel.
Let's go a little slower over that. Syria is ruled now for maybe eight dynasties by the descendants of Alexander. And particularly by the family of the Seleucids and those that followed them. Egypt is in the hands of another general, the Ptolemies. Remember, the Ptolemies caused art and culture to flourish and the Hellenization of the world. And the second of the Ptolemies built the great library down there. And they commissioned the translation of the Bible into the Greek Septuagint. And it was a time when Egypt was flourishing, and there's nothing. Israel's just sitting there, sort of nothing much has happened. The Persians are going to let the Jews go back into the Holy Land pretty soon, but hadn't quite happened yet at this point. Now, these kings, particularly the kings in Syria, are not particularly good guys. The one man that we focus on is a very, very bad guy. He gets in office by unlawful means, takes the throne by an unlawful power, and then he decides to fight back and forth with Egypt. And he is successful on his first campaign down into Egypt. Now we get the Romans begin to get involved in here, and the Egyptians call for the Romans to help, and the Jews would like to have the Romans come and help because the wars back and forth all across Israel aren't very convenient. So the Roman general, what's his name? Pompey? I think it's Pompey. Drives his jeep on the beach down by... So that by Gaza, in the Gaza Strip, and runs on to Antiochus Epiphanes while he's coming back from Egypt and says, you can't do this anymore, no more trips back and forth. And that makes Antiochus Epiphanes very, very angry. Nobody's going to tell him what he can do. But he's got no power to stop him. He can't do anything against the Roman force. But on the other way home, he decides to wreak havoc in Jerusalem. So he goes into Jerusalem and destroys the sacred vessels on the altar, tears them all down, offers a pig in sacrifice on the altar, and takes pig broth and sprinkles it all over everything and kills the high priest and the priests and passes a bunch of new laws that stopped the Jewish sacrifice dead cold. And there's a lot of life lost. And he takes the treasury out of the temple and runs it back home to Damascus. And it's a really terrible story. And it looks like this is the end of the Jews. They're just getting their act back together again after 70 years in Babylon. And now this happens. Well, that's the end of Antiochus Epiphanes' damage. You can't do any more damage. What happens next? Good. He needs exercise.
Does anybody else want to answer this first? Well, you have a character by the name of Judas Maccabeus, who's I believe he's a priest. And he's a little bit ticked off at all this, and he decides enough is enough. And even though he's got a really small force, he starts engaging in guerrilla tactics against Antiochus, and he ends up winning.
Good. Okay. A group of very righteous, brave Jews in Jerusalem, the Maccabees, a family, rises up to rectify the situation by throwing out the Syrians. And he does that over a period of time. It is successful. And so they restore the sanctity of the temple and clean it all up and get the sacrifice running again and light the lamp, which has been out, and restore the sacrifice in the temple. It's restored sacrifice is actually mentioned in one of the Gospels. But what time of year did that happen? Was that around Easter?
December.
In fact, is that holiday long forgotten?
No,
it isn't. What is that holiday? The Jews? Hanukkah. And what's the date? December 25th. And Hanukkah, which the Jews celebrate every year at December 25th, looks like Christmas but isn't. It's the celebration of the work of the Maccabees in destroying and restoring the temple service and sanctifying it again. It's a great story of heroism by the small handful of Jews. John 10.
It's what's called the Feast of the Dedication.
Feast of the Dedication, and there's a mention of Jesus being in town for that.
Right. So
it seems to have real integrity as far as ongoing Jewish feasts are concerned. Okay. Now, I was reading from the Bible here a minute ago, but, and then we got off onto secular matters.
You're saying, of course, that this is the fulfillment of this horn, correct?
Now, we got to get into why that's in there.
Yeah.
This really bad guy is the man that Jesus spoke about in Matthew 24, who is the man of sin or the abomination that makes desolate. I mean, remember when Jesus took four of his disciples up onto the Mount of Olives and talked to them about the future? They wanted to know when he was coming and a bunch of things like that. And in the course of that time, Jesus told the Jews, he said, if you happen to be living in Jerusalem, when you see the man of sin standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, get out of town, essentially, get out of Jerusalem. So there's coming a day when a man like Antiochus Epiphanes, evil and bad, goes into the temple in Jerusalem and desecrates it in a particularly bad way. And that's so precipitous an event that any believing Jews should get out of Jerusalem right away and go actually out of the country to Petra and be safe there because war is going to break out. Now, there is no temple in Jerusalem right now. So that can't be fulfilled, right? Unless the Jews build a temple, and they're ready to do that right now. They have all the materials and all the spare parts and everything. So that's ready. If you want to look, read up on it, go to the website templefoundation.org, I think it is, in Jerusalem. They have magnificent drawings, architectural plans of the temple. Already, I think they've built, or they are building, the Sanhedrin courtroom where the Sanhedrin will meet, and they've appointed a group of 70 elders to be the judges. And I think they had 47,000 priests in training and ready to minister in that temple. And they're agitating now to get permission to build the temple on the Temple Mount, and it will be built quickly.
Good luck.
Yeah, now it's an international conflict a little bit, but the existence of a temple in Jerusalem in the last days is mentioned three times. Yeah.
For them to erect the temple on the site means
demolishing the Dome of the Rock,
or
the third holiest site for Islam. And I mean, that sounds like war.
Yeah, I went over there with a bunch of with Ray and a bunch of people in 1983, I guess it was, to see if we could find where the original two temples were located, because you don't know exactly. The Jews would like to build this temple exactly on the location of the first two temples. And the Dome of the Rock, that Muslim shrine, is probably not the right site. Everybody thinks it is because it's so prominent. But there's a couple of other theories. And that it maybe have to be compromised for political reasons. But that they're ready to build it. And somehow, perhaps very soon, somebody's going to get authorization somehow. Probably in some peace treaty between the Muslims and the and Europe, or some kind of exchange, land for peace, squabble going on, they'll get permission to build the temple. I expect they'll have it all built and running in a year or so. Okay, so we get the temple building up and functioning in the New Testament. Now, something's going to happen in that temple building. What's going to... This somebody like this man of sin is going to come into Jerusalem, into the temple, and what happens then? He is going to go into the Holy of Holies and declare that he is God. How can he, and the whole world is going to see this, how can the whole world see that, that's actually happening?
CNN.
Only the high priest can go into the Holy of Holies, but everything in this new temple, you can see in the architectural plans, there's plans for every modern appliance and convenience in the new temple. So it'll be no problem to let the whole world know that there's been an incident in Jerusalem, and that this man who claims to be the Messiah, counterfeit Messiah, has gone into the Holy of Holies and he has announced that he's God. And that's this abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. That's the first occurrence of it is called the type, the illustration. And now we have the anti-type, or the fulfillment of it. And Jesus spoke of that very event.
So is it safe to say that the people living at the time of Jesus would have looked at Daniel 8 and seen initially that this referred to Antiochus Epiphanes? Would they have interpreted it that way? But then Jesus is saying one like him yet is coming.
Yeah, Jesus would have made it clear enough that it hadn't happened yet, but that if they knew their history or they got out their books, this had already happened in type. And that do you remember what else this man of sin does? He declares that he's God. That's pretty offensive to everybody, to the Jews. What else does he do? He says, "Oh, I got a friend, the man of sin. I've got a military financial leader, either in Europe or in Russia, in the old Roman Empire, who's going to pay our bills and work out a peace treaty for us here." So we have a beast and a false prophet, or these two bad guys. One of them's the Antichrist, and then this guy here is probably the guy we call the false prophet. So the Antiochus figure goes into the temple, announces that he's God, and commands everybody to worship the Antichrist. Then the next thing he does is erect a statue of that man in the Holy of Holies, a moving, talking statue of all things, animated like Disney, and tells the world to worship this beast and its image. Now, what's so wrong with that? Is it just some? Why is this so terrible? You want to get out of Jerusalem? That this is the time. This is the time of terrible tribulation, particularly for the Jews, a time of Jacob's trouble that's going to be the most terrible time of suffering for the whole planet. Why? Is it just Israel? No, it's all of us. What's God showing the world? Doesn't affect us, of course. Oh, yes, it does. Who's got some comments on why, on this whole thing, why it's going down this way? Phyllis has that answer.
Well, God will not be mocked. He tells us that all the way through Scripture.
Okay, God will not be mocked. And this whole activity is a terrible mocking of God and His holiness and the law of Moses and everything that God has stood for, and the law and all of that is now being mocked by these guys openly, as if God isn't already being mocked pretty badly. And the whole system of God's rule over the world through Israel is upside down. Two evil guys that are, in fact, incarnations of Satan are taking over the world and deceiving and with much treachery. Jesus said to the Jews, I have come in my Father's name, and you would not receive me. You Jews would not receive me. Another will come in his own name, and him you will receive. That's pretty scary, yeah.
Let me refer back to chapter 7, verse 9. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. And it talks about the 24 people sitting in their thrones in this picture that's drawn. Since last week, you probably have to be familiar with Shakespeare, but I'm thinking of a device, a play within a play. And this, to me, is a climactic, is that God finally sits in his throne, and all these people are gathered in heaven to watch the play. It's like a Midsummer's Night's Dream, with the fairies causing havoc. And the people, if people know that play, if you don't, you should read it. And this thing all plays out. And I'm also drawn to the fact that Syria is still Syria. And Egypt is still Egypt. And Iran is still Iran. And all these, and Israel is still Israel. Nothing has changed. And now we get to be part of this. We're drawn into this drama.
Everybody see that? It is absolutely phenomenal that should all be coming out in our lifetime, right at the end of history. The final chapters. Chapter 7 of Daniel was the foreview of the judgment of Jesus over the whole world and the judgment of all of these four empires, including the final form of the old Roman Empire. And the Antichrist in chapter 7, the Antichrist himself and his cohorts take full control of the whole world for 3.5 years during that time period. So it's all there. Armageddon is the name of a hill up in the valley of Esdraelon, up in inland from Haifa, when Napoleon visited the Mount of Armageddon and looked out over this big green valley, he said, "Well, this is a perfect place for a war." He said, and it is a perfect place for, because you could put the land armies there just about. The final war takes place in several facets. The tribulation, or the great tribulation, the last 7 years of history is called the tribulation period. That's 7 years long. That time period begins with the departure of the church. Now, we may have differences of point of view here, but the point that starts it all running would be the rapture of the church. When Jesus comes down, takes true believers out, leaves the false believers behind, and we will be with Jesus for 7 years as the bride of Christ, new bodies, everything all new with Jesus, who will then begin to judge the whole world through such things as we see in the book of Revelation through those terrible wars and earthquakes and times of destruction, the human race will go through this horrific time of judgment, and particularly the Jews for the last 3.5 years. The final war that has to do with Israel in the last 3.5 years starts with Jesus telling the Jews to get out of Jerusalem. The Jews will all be scattered probably down to Petra, down south in what used to be Edom, the old land of Edom. And down in the land of Edom, Jesus will raise from the dead all of the Jews who've ever lived, believers and unbelievers, sort them all out. This is in Ezekiel. Sort them all out, and when the time's right, take all the believing Jews back into the land so they can inherit the kingdom. The land armies of Europe will come roaring in. We have an invasion from Egypt, from the south, colliding with an invasion from Russia and Persia, which sort of self-destructs along the coast. And then we have another land invasion by the final ruler of Iraq and Persia, who's called the Assyrian in the Bible. We'd say the Antichrist comes in. So a lot of the fighting is armies of the world fighting against one another. But at the heart of it is the battle for ownership of Jerusalem. And Jesus said if those days had not been shortened, no human being would be saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. So the Lord Jesus Christ himself will step back into history at Jerusalem personally and put an end to the last war and take up residence in Jerusalem on the throne of David. And bring all the elect Jews back in to Israel to occupy the kingdom that had been promised to them. All Jews living in other countries are brought back. Anybody else who survives this war, the survivors will be all divided into believers and unbelievers, and the believers get to stay on earth and rebuild things. Now, where are we? Well, the bride and the bridegroom come back as the king and queen over the earth, live in New Jerusalem, and enjoy the universe forever. That all crystal clear? If I have left you so confused that it'll ruin your day or your week or your life, would you catch me now or so that we can... I'm not the only one with views that disagree with some other with others. I pretty well hold got this from race.
You're passing the buck. But no, I have one question, and this is probably a little sidebar. But I think we're watching something that we don't always talk about take place daily. And that's where Isaiah talks, and I would love for you to put some light on this if you can, where Isaiah talks about Damascus will be no more. And this is the first time, at least in modern times, where we've ever seen fighting like we're seeing, and Damascus is being leveled. And so where does that fit into all this?
Isaiah says that Damascus will cease to be a city. And in one place it says in one day, so it's probably going to get a nuclear bomb dropped on it. Now, Syria's been quiet up until recently with a nasty, bad dictator, but now there's this self-destructive civil war going on, and everybody in the whole region is fighting to get in on one side or another of Syria and to have the land. It's right next to Israel. Russia's all involved. Iran's all involved. The power of politics going on there is absolutely amazing. That's just in the last year. And Syria, these ancient names are all back in place again with big armies. Isn't that interesting? So Russia, the player. The United States is not mentioned in the Bible anywhere that I know of, but we probably will be a military power in the at the end. If you remember the war with Saddam Hussein, when we went over there and took out Saddam and liberated Iraq and Iran, I suspect the next thing that happens in that area will be a rebuilding of Assyria. That right here at Babylon, there will be a new Nimrod and a new army in the Middle East. That it's, you got to fit that Assyrian guy has to fit in here someplace. I didn't intend to go all over the map here, but it's happening. it's incredible to me how much peace God gives his people. If your eyes are on him, how much protection, how you can watch these things and not be scared out of your wits. But it's happening, and the next event that I expect will be the departure of the church when we get called home.
How far are we gone?
15.
Okay. I'm going to go back to the one that says that the goat comes from the far west. Where's that? Yeah. In verse 5. He, goat, came from the west. On the face of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look on the globe and track it backwards, you know, the westward, the same latitude.
Yeah.
Iraq and Iran, and go all the way around to the back of the earth. That's the United States.
That's why I think it's the United States. What I would agree with you is that the nations of the world, these old nations, seem to have their same character that they had here in the Bible. They're vicious and cruel and bad guys, like wild animals, and that's not changed. So isn't that interesting? After all these years, that empty Middle East should be filled back up with a ancient powers, and they're all configured around, and governments are changing. All those governments have just about been changed. Egypt in the last year, and now Syria, and Turkey. Turkey was pro-Israeli until a year ago, and now they're pro-Arab. Yes?
In verse 14, it says 2,300 evenings and mornings. What does that mean?
Let's see, where was this? Was
14.
Of chapter 8. Okay, so this is Antiochus Epiphanes being prophesied of what he's going to do. The real Antiochus Epiphanes, who hasn't showed up on the earth yet, is going to do these things. The army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices. He cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. So the final Antichrist is going to do the same thing as the first guy did, only worse. I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgressions of desolation and the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? How long is the desecration of the temple going to last in time? And the answer is for 2,300, your translation may say days, the Hebrew or the Greek says mornings and evenings, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. So that turns out to be, it's probably evenings and mornings. There's a morning sacrifice and an evening sacrifice. So if you count those two sacrifices, half of 2,300 days or 1,150 days, the time period before the temple is restored again. Is that okay? Antiochus' persecution of the Jews would last for 2,300 years. And that was fulfilled. Okay. There's a bunch of numbers on here. In the book of Revelation, there's numbers that have to do with when Jesus will actually sit on the throne and when he's coronated and when the temple's dedicated. There's got to build a new temple, too, after the one that's on its way gets destroyed.
Would it be fair to say that there is two types of Jews here? The one of Romans 2:28 says, for a Jew is not a Jew outwardly, nor is he circumcised outwardly in the flesh.
Yep.
But he is a Jew inwardly.
Yep.
And circumcised in his heart, in the spirit.
This is what makes Romans such a great book, because it makes clear who is a real believer and who is not a real believer. And of course, Romans 9, 10, and 11 points that out, that a real Jew is somebody who knows the Lord Jesus and has the righteousness of Christ within him, not the Jew who's observant to the law or who's only observant in outward conduct. So most all of these Jews in this action are unbelieving. Most all the Jews in Israel will be destroyed. In fact, we know from Zechariah that 2/3 of the Jews in Israel will be destroyed in this last war. 1/3 of the Jews in the world were destroyed by Hitler. This time it's going to be worse. We 2/3. And about half the Jews in the world are in the U.S. right now, and the other half are in Israel. It's interesting how many are still here. But of all the Jews in the world who believe in Jesus, it's only a small number, maybe 100,000 in all of Israel. We have a few synagogues here and there that are believing, but most are not. The newspaper I mentioned, the website I mentioned, the Temple Mount people who are planning to build the temple are Orthodox Jews, but they will have nothing to do with Jesus as their Messiah. Absolutely, they're vehement in their opposition to Jesus. So that means that you can't take everything that they tell you as if it's going to happen in history, because it can't.
Say, Lambert, it just occurred to me that maybe another sign of the end times occurred on the floor of the Democratic Convention when they had that roll call, that very embarrassing. I mean, if I were a Democrat,
well, I thought that was
really embarrassed.
Fascinating.
I mean, because he called for the vote 3 times, and every time the no's were louder. So if this had happened in the Republican Convention, I imagine the same thing would have, similar thing would have happened. Because the inconvenient truth of Jerusalem and God is such that the remnant theology that I have acquired here suggests that there are not a lot of true believers around. Right?
No, they're not. Even in the church, they're not, sadly. Except here, of course. Compulsory here.
I was at the Republican National.
Oh, she was there?
And there are a lot of believers
there. Okay. Are there? Okay.
Can I just ask, follow on to Jackie's question, that you're saying that we would interpret the 2,300 evenings and mornings as half of that in a number of days?
Some commentators do. So
and does that map to how long Antiochus Epiphanes had the temple desecrated?
I think that's right. I mean, look that up next time.
Here's Delsky.
If you the website's got a lot of notes on it, tons of notes, Ray's old notes and our old notes, and if you go on the website, you can dig into this.
I have a note, I don't know where it's from, that this 2,300 evenings and mornings refers to the origin of the Seventh-day Adventists.
That's right. The Seventh-day Adventists get their eschatology from this part of Matthew 24 here, and this, because they put the, oh dear, I can't get to the rapture without that. I don't. I think wheelchairs go first, though. Cynthia?
No, I was just saying yes.
Oh, you're right. I hadn't planned on all these details, and there's so much material on our website that you can spend a week at it and catch up. It's a good idea to start catching up on it.
Lambert, I was going to say, while all these numbers are great, as believers, we're going to be gone. I think this
is more
like for people who are around going, oh, my gosh, look what's been written.
Yes.
I think it's for them more.
It's for
helping us. But I, and that's my own personal take
That is so good. There's no date setting for us. We're just going to go without any notice whatsoever, and everybody's going to be startled. And we're going to leave in a very short twinkling of an eye. And then all this date and counting is for the people left behind if they want to start figuring it out, and particularly for the Jews. The redemption of the whole world centers around Israel. Israel is number one of all the nations. The king of the world sits on the throne of Israel. That's Jesus. And we are all the Gentile nations. So we don't come in at number one at all. I think we could quit. Here, is this? Have I left you head spinning?
No.
Well, thank you. I always underestimate you people. You're so smart and learned. I know we're going to be high place up in heaven someplace. Father, thank you for this book, which is so filled with accurate information and such detail and information that can challenge any of us and all of us to study, to be aware of the times we live in. It's pretty clear now that we're coming to the end of the age, that we should all be ready. We're supposed to be ready no matter when. We should be alert to our non-Christian friends who are searching and looking, and perhaps we can put them on the right track here. It's so sad to see the lack of integrity in government and politics and schools, and to see the dumbing down of our whole culture and the dumbing down even of churches, the unbelief that is just everywhere. Wake us up, Father, so that we don't have to be ashamed when you come and call us home. We can be thankful and glad that we majored in the Bible and walked with you. And thank you for the Lord Jesus and his beauty and the wonderful help that he gives us every day in our lives, and the splendor of his being that we can begin to see through a glass darkly right now. And thanks for our group. Guard us and protect us and strengthen us in the name of Jesus. Amen.